Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassang. Probably most people are aware that today is Father's Day, and it's an occasion for remembering, hopefully with gratitude, all the goodness that we received from our fathers. And all of us, of course, are, I'm sure by this stage of life, aware that without a lot of care and attention from our parents, we wouldn't have done so well. And so we owe our parents a huge debt, even if, as is often the case, there's things we don't agree about with our parents, and still there's a huge sacrifice made so that we survive, even physically, not to mention socially. And this encouragement that we have in our society to put one day aside to reflect with appreciation on the goodness we've received is very much in keeping with our Buddha's teachings, to remember those who have benefited us and not make the unfortunate mistake of taking all the goodness that we've received for granted. It's easy to do. It's like, just for instance, the physical experience of if you're getting around having a healthy body and everything's okay, and then something happens, you have an accident and you break an arm or break a leg or something, and your mind is preoccupied with, when I get well again, I'm really going to appreciate being healthy. And sometimes it's the case that it's only when we lose the comfort and the convenience that we really come to appreciate how fortunate we are. And so having days like this to reflect with gratitude on the benefit we received from our fathers. Also, it was just 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was reflecting here on my gratitude towards one of my spiritual fathers, Ajahn Sumedho, and spoke about that occasion at Amrawati where we were marking Ajahn Sumedho's 90th birthday, and this celebration of gratitude, many hundreds of people together, monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, spending several days together in this celebration of gratitude towards somebody who had given us huge benefit, the benefit of faith, at the very least. Different people benefit in different ways, however, at the very least, I'm sure everybody there would agree that we all have benefited from the teachings that we've received from Ajahn Sumedho of faith, faith in true principles. There's something that we can have confidence in. This is a really precious gift. If you look, well, perhaps you can look at your own life. I can certainly reflect back on my life before I encountered the Buddha's teachings, and in theory and then in practice, and what a chaos, what a mess. And you look around in the world that we live in, and there's so many people ostensibly intelligent and apparently educated, and yet evidently seriously unhappy. What's going on there? Why is there so much chaos when there's so much information, so much cleverness, so much competence in certain areas? Well, from a spiritual perspective, there's a core element that's missing, and that's confidence or trust or faith in true principles, or in Buddhism we call it Dhamma. And certainly this is something that Ajahn Sumedho and our teachers have given us, this through the evidence of their example and through their teachings, this induction, if you like, into the view that there is something that we can trust in. There is order, there's implicit order within the apparent chaos. If we have a purely materialistic perspective on experience, on life, on the world, we don't factor in the heart dimension or the consciousness dimension, then we can be defined by that chaos. And for many people, that's what they struggle with, trying to find something that gives them a sense of security. And these days, often, that sense of security is sought by holding to, identifying as the thoughts, the views, the opinions, the preferences, in other words, the conditioned personality. The conditioned personality is their refuge. The conditioned sense of self is their orientation, is their source of, their attempted source of security. And again, the evidence is that it's not working very well, because fundamentally so many people are disoriented. So the gift of something to trust in, something to have faith in, that Ajahn Sumedho and our other teachers have given us, is something really precious. And it's natural that, having received such a precious gift, that we want to express gratitude. And so that event at Amrawati was a beautiful celebration of gratitude. Also a celebration of generosity. The generosity that was expressed in that gratitude, also a celebration of Ajahn Sumedho's generosity and the generosity of our teachers. And I think back the number of times that I would go and see Ajahn Sumedho, and confused and disoriented and struggling, and he would generously give, not just of his time, also of his attention and of his experience, all those years that he'd been practicing ahead of us, and the struggles that he had endured, and the discoveries that he had made. The generosity of heart to share is a wonderful thing. And we see that, and that generosity is a very beautiful thing, certainly something worth celebrating. Yeah. Generosity and gratitude as mere concepts, while they're interesting, we can think a lot about them and perhaps write a lot about them. As feelings, right? When you sense like generosity, I remember sitting with Ajahn Chah, when I think back now about the time I spent with Ajahn Chah and the generosity of his time. Why would he want to put up with this scruffy, confused young Westerner sitting there suffering the consequences of his past heedlessness? And I certainly wasn't paying him anything for his time or his attention, and yet the extraordinary generosity of Ajahn Chah and our teachers and their willingness to be available to us, sharing their life, not merely sharing their opinions. And I remember one experience in going to see Ajahn Chah, and I was so full of doubt and really, really distressed. And Ajahn Chah didn't just say, "Oh well, read this discourse by the Buddha and be patient and everything will be all right." If that's all he'd said, I probably wouldn't have remembered it. However, what I do remember is the way he looked at me and listened to me and said, "Oh, I've been like that. You know, I went through a period when I had so much doubt that I thought my brains were going to burst." And that generosity of spirit, that generosity of heart, that's a beautiful gift. And so, thinking back to that occasion at Amrawati, a celebration of generosity, a celebration of gratitude, and the good fortune that we can live nourished by faith. It's tempting, given the education we receive and the stimulation of certain parts of our left brain, that we become besotted by intellectual certainty, having conceptual answers to life. However, we all know, presumably, that having good ideas about how we should be, how we should feel, and how the world should be is nowhere near enough. We probably all have lots of good ideas. However, we still, despite all our good ideas, we still struggle with life, and the world struggles. It needs more than merely good ideas. We need to go deeper. And so, what is it that inspires us to dare to go deeper, to go into the frightening territory of the unknown? It's faith, it's trust, trust in true principles, that there is implicit order. Being enamored, being besotted by conceptual clarity can be a distraction. It's important to have a degree of mental clarity about what the Buddha was teaching, what constitutes right practice. However, we need to do much more than that. Or at least we're interested in doing more than that, which is why we're willing to sit in silence for half an hour, making the effort, because we trust that there's something to be discovered. There is an order that we can seek for. And when we don't have it, then we see that's the consequence of so much unhappiness, so much confusion, so much sadness, so much bitterness, so much resentment. And it doesn't have to be that way. And again, I know from my own experience of so much confusion, so much sadness, so much disappointment, and the struggle with it. And then you hear the teachings and you practice the teachings. So, now, there is something we can do about it. There is this practice where we can learn to skillfully, usually through trial and error, and sometimes quite a lot of errors and getting it wrong, learn how to discipline attention. And just the same as learning to use a power tool in the workshop, or learning how to play a musical instrument. In the beginning, you pick it up and you can maybe make some unpleasant noises. How do we learn to produce beautiful music? Through practice. And so it is this training, this opportunity, the practice of skillfully disciplining attention so as to be able to meet life in its joy, in its gladness, in its sorrow, and in its sadness, the whole spectrum of human experience, how to meet it in our whole being, not just conceptually and abstraction in our head, to feel what we feel and not be defined by those feeling reactions. We have all sorts of reactions. Things that we learned when we were young, we picked up from our primary carers to have all sorts of reactions that probably we don't want to spend our life following. And yet here we are, having this kind of an emotional reaction to something. Likes and dislikes, preferences, it's all conditioned. Do we want to spend our life defined by the conditioning that we received, or do we want to live our lives consciously, optimizing on this opportunity to cultivate what we bow down to, that is the Buddha, that is selfless wisdom, selfless compassion. If we do, then once again, it's faith that sustains us, in my experience. I've spoken before about some experiences that I had in my early years of practice and that precipitated some utterly unexpected shifts in perspective on experience. I mean, wow, that can happen. Didn't even know that was possible. And at the time, when maybe some of you have had such experiences with a significant shift in perspective and the joy, the relief that that new perspective offers, and maybe there's the impression, well, this is how it's going to be from here on out, only to be surprised to realize, well, it's not like that. In fact, often what happens, and certainly in my own case, what happened after those interesting and very welcome shifts in perspective was enormous increased chaos. certainly with regards to that second experience, and this increased sensitivity to life meant that I found I had a huge backlog of pain to deal with. Sometimes it looked almost intolerable. Obviously it was tolerable because I'm still here. There were many times, and I'm not just talking about hours or days, I'm talking about years, many, many years of intense pain. In my own case, the feeling of intense badness. Where did all this come from? Here I am busy keeping all these precepts. I haven't misbehaved that badly, surely. And yet there's this really heavy burden, this darkness of badness. And where did it come from? How do we sort it out? Are we obliged to just distract ourselves from it? Well, thankfully, again, the teachings that we have can inspire us to trust, to have confidence that just because it looks intolerable doesn't mean to say it is intolerable. There's always something we can do about our situation, even when it appears otherwise. So once again, what was it that meant that after some encounters with states that were rather agreeable, that sometimes, and I know I'm not alone in this, we find ourselves having to deal with that which is intensely disagreeable, and how do we deal with it? And the reason for it, I would suggest, is that it's the baggage. We could talk about it anyway as the personal baggage that we brought with us. Or we could talk about it as our karma. Or if you're familiar with the research and these days into what's called epigenetics, maybe that's what it is. Whatever it is, it's something we've brought with us. And the challenge, if we want to really progress in this life, is to develop the competence that means that we can turn this around, that which is apparently intolerable and confusing and disorienting, into something that's truly relevant, meaningful, even beneficial. So once again, emphasizing that gift, that good fortune that we've all already received because we're here and we've encountered these teachings, and the faith, the trust, the confidence that comes when we hear the Buddha's encouragement to inquire into the actuality of experience. The Buddha didn't just give us a belief system. He pointed out there's a way of training our faculties, just as we have physical faculties, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body sensation, for navigating our way around the external world. We have the internal faculties of faith or confidence, energy, mindfulness, collectedness, discernment, the five spiritual faculties, which we're encouraged to cultivate. These potentials can be just laying dormant, or we can engage with them. We can engage with faith, and then remember that is very different from blind belief. We can be taught to believe in all sorts of things, and we can hold to those beliefs, the things that go on in our head. Faith, trust, confidence it's more than just mere belief. It's a feeling, it's a sense, it's a disposition of being, it's a disposition. It's an open disposition which has potential, which can be very different from beliefs. If we hold beliefs in our head, we can be very closed to life and just, I believe in this and that's it, and anybody else who doesn't believe it, well, I don't care about them. Trust, faith, confidence in true principles can be cultivated, should be cultivated. We're encouraged to cultivate, not just naive, wishful thinking. Energy can be cultivated. Mindfulness can be cultivated. Collectedness can be cultivated. Discernment can be cultivated. So there's something we can do about our experience of life, whatever it is, the confusion, the sadness, the disappointment. The Buddha encourages, don't just blindly believe in anything. Don't blindly disbelieve in anything. Rather exercise these potential competences that we have, Santa Virya Satismari Panya, exercise them and investigate our relationship to disappointment. Are we obliged to be defined by this feeling of disappointment? Of course we're going to feel disappointed. Summer changes into autumn, autumn changes into winter, it gets cold, the electricity goes out, the gas runs out. Of course we feel disappointed. Why would we feel disappointed? That's disappointing. Do we have to be pulled down by disappointment? Or the loss of a loved one? That loss is disappointing, it's sad. Do we have to be defined, pulled down by sadness? Or is there a way, and this is the question, that inspires faith, the doubt, the question, the interest. Is there a way of living with disappointment, with sadness, with these utterly, perfectly predictable, normal human experiences without being defined by them? Or once again, having contact with teachers, being able to see teachers and be seen by teachers, that experience I mentioned a minute ago of being able to sit with Ajahn Chah and feel seen by Ajahn Chah, feel heard by Ajahn Chah. What a gift, what a beautiful gift that was, and how nourishing that was of faith and confidence. Or the experiences we have ourselves, like we go on retreat, and or sometimes spontaneously just a shift takes place in perspective and say, wow, that's possible, I had no idea that was possible. I had no idea that was possible to view life like that. And out of that also faith can come, and that strength that comes from that is a powerful resource. So how do we deal with the confusion, the disorientation that we are all obliged to deal with, whether it's before or after some apparently significant experience or practice? Well, faith is core, I would say. Also, it's core, and this is something that I meant to talk about in the talk I gave a couple of weeks ago called Trusting and Open-Hearted Awareness. I meant to talk about the essential practice of patient endurance, and I omitted to. So I want to emphasize that this evening, that in this effort to deal with life's challenges, let's not underestimate the power of patient endurance. Sometimes, because we are so keen on overcoming problems and we're so driven by becoming, bhava tanha, craving to develop, craving to get better, craving to overcome, craving to succeed, we're so driven by that, that we miss the point that life flows according to all sorts of conditions, not just our wishes. Not just because we want something to change, want to get over something, doesn't mean to say it's going to happen. It's like using, again, we all know the changing seasons. And look at our garden out here now in the Memorial Garden. Beautiful garden. Looks so beautiful this time of year. And then I remember just a few weeks ago, the winter this year, the winter just seemed to drag on and on and on. The garden was looking wretched. Just what a disappointing garden. And it's never going to change. And here we are, just a few weeks. However, it didn't change according to my preferences. It changed according to its own nature. And this is life. There's so many conditioning factors that condition change and development, including the change and development of our own heart, of our own consciousness, our own awareness, and some of the challenges, some of the difficulties, some of the denied life that we encounter, the denied dukkha that we've stored away in unawareness. When we encounter it, it takes patient endurance. Not bitter endurance, which is like gritting your teeth and wishing this would go away. You know, that's not what we're talking about. It's a willingness to bear with, a recognition that there's power in willingness to bear with that which feels unbearable. There's a power in that, there's a strength in that. And sometimes it's essential, because as I mentioned, the backlog of denied dukkha, again, it's energy. All of us, you know, our brains are still developing till the age of 25, and by that stage, most of us have stored away all sorts of experiences and unawareness that we wished hadn't happened, though did happen, and we didn't deal with them, we weren't ready. It's not that we were bad or something wrong with us, it's just the strategy we employed was one of parking that pain in the belly in unawareness. That was how we survived, and possibly exactly the right thing to do at the time. However, if it's still there, locked in the system, and it engaged some spiritual exercises and it surfaces again, what are we going to do with it? Well, let's remember patience. Patience, endurance, that willingness to bear with it is essential. It's like a burning. In fact, the word, when the Buddha talked about patient endurance, he called it the ultimate austerity. Patient endurance is tapo titika in Pali. Tapo is like the Pali word for austerity, ascetic practices. However, the etymology of that word, the word tapas, is burning. And that's it with patience. It can feel like a burning. That's why Ajahn Jayasaro translates that little line from the Buddha's teachings as patient endurance is the ultimate incinerator. This is the Buddha speaking. A patient endurance is the ultimate, or as I prefer to call it, the ultimate transformer. It transforms our experience. It's like compost. It stinks. It's dirty. It looks a mess. It breaks down and becomes manure and becomes nourishment. So let's remember that when we're dealing with life's challenges, patient endurance is essential, certainly in my own life, and coming to terms with what at times has seemed like utterly unfair, intense badness, difficulties, intensity. You can't fix it, can't overcome it. Talking helps. Gratitude to our teachers who listen to us. However, sometimes we're just left with having to bear with it. Sometimes also what's called for is adjusting our practice, and I know in my own case, if I can continue to speak about that, is finding ways of bringing the practice more into the body. I've seen many people over the years practicing meditation, reading teachings, listening to teachings, going on retreat. They're still primarily, essentially, finding their identity in their thinking mind, in their heads. And there's a whole lot of data available that's not being processed. It's happening in the heart dimension or in the belly dimension. In what we feel, what we intuit. Yes, conceptual intelligence is great. It's a wonderful tool. What about emotional intelligence? What about intuitive intelligence? And so what I found useful was this. I had a friend who was teaching this what's called conscious connected breathing technique. Yes, this particular rhythmic breathing, charging the body up with energy, and then there's aliveness that's accessible, this extraordinary, delightful, pleasurable aliveness in the body, which is like an ability to read the body, which I didn't know you could do before. Sort of had some sense of reading my mind and what was going on in my head. However, what I didn't realize was how illiterate I was with regards to my body. And so using these disciplined breathing techniques made an enormous difference. And it's like opening up channels, so to speak, similar to what happens, or what I think happens. I can't claim to understand what acupuncturists get up to, though when I listen to them talking, they talking about these opening up these channels, and this has also been my experience, particularly in recent years, found this very good acupuncturist who made a few tweaks to my system, and the benefit is enormous. You know, I didn't even know that was possible. And years of meditation and chiropractors and osteopaths and exercises and qigong, and then just a few treatments of acupuncture. And one of the things that immediately changed for me was these terrible migraine-type headaches that I had been having for many years. And just after a few treatments of acupuncture, just gone. These strong drugs that I was taking, again, for years, which I wished I wasn't doing. However, given the pain that I was having to endure, I thought, no, I'll take the drugs, and thank you very much. And just a few acupuncture treatments, gone. And for at least 2 years now, I haven't taken a single one of these pills. And other experiences with the result of acupuncture. The reason I mention this is because sometimes it does need intervention. You know, if something is blocked in the system, if we deny dukkha intensely enough, willfully enough, for long enough, then it's like obstructions become established within our bodies that even though we might want to work with the pain of life, we're just not able to. One of the most dramatic benefits of these acupuncture treatments that I've had is this sensation of a release, a tremendous sense of release in my heart area, in the center of my chest, which again I had no idea was possible. So, how is that possible? A sense of freedom, of it's like being able to breathe again. So I didn't even realize it was so contracted. And with even an initial degree of being released from the heart contraction, that initial degree of opening is a hugely increased capacity for processing the pain of life. You know, once again, bringing the practice down out of the head into the body so that we're really dealing with the raw dukkha. And we get used at a very early stage of life to be thinking about life's problems, to be thinking about how do I deal with this resentment that I have towards such and such a person. Or that fear I have of that experience that I had at such and such a time, that fear of that happening again. From the perspective of open-hearted awareness, fear is a sensation that can be met. Disappointment is a sensation, like an energetic movement that can be met. You can read that and say, what is the effect of resisting this reality, the reality of dukkha? What is the effect of it? Is this happening or am I doing this? You know, we are actually, a lot of the time, we're the agents of these obstructions that we experience. We might think that it's happening to us. However, if we can start to read more accurately in the body, not just in abstraction in our heads, really read as a feeling sense, then we can again deepen. Fear becomes information. And it applies not just within oneself, but also in relationship. Sometimes I practice these days with welcoming painful feelings, literally welcoming them, bringing up images into my heart, into my chest, and just welcoming the painful feeling there to see, is it possible to stay open and feel this feeling without enacting the habit of contraction, of denial? Feels so natural, it's such a habit to deny the pain of life, and yet the Buddha told us over and over again, it's through not knowing two things that we stay stuck in this unfortunate circumstance, not knowing dukkha, not knowing the cause of dukkha. And that's an interesting philosophy. However, we need much more than just believing in that or being impressed by that. We need to study the actuality, the raw data of having somebody dislike me. You might think living in monasteries, we all get on together and we're all happy all the time together. Well, we're not. Just like any other human communities, we don't all like each other all the time at all. Sometimes we downright dislike each other. What do we do with that when, well, sometimes these days I practice sitting there and in my mind, in my heart, I say, your dislike is welcome. I welcome your dislike and feel the feeling of being disliked. Or your criticism. People tend to want to criticize anybody in position of authority. Certainly the abbot of a monastery is a sitting duck for criticism. And I don't like it being criticized. And so I sit there feeling it. Your criticisms are welcome. Can we stay open-hearted and sensitive and feel the feeling, the disagreeable feeling of being criticized to the point where we're not making it worse? Doesn't mean to say we like it. We're not talking about, you know, making sour lemons taste sweet. I mean, lemons always taste sour. Can we taste the sourness of the lemon without complaining about it, saying it shouldn't be this way? Lemons shouldn't taste sour. There's something wrong with the world. Lemons taste sour. Well, that's like saying, you know, having somebody project their dislike on us hurts. Do we have to make it worse by saying it shouldn't be this way? So, once again, getting back to this question of, can we live in this world with all the chaos, all the confusion, all the disorientation there is around and be a victim to it? Or is there something we can do about it? Well, thankfully, we've heard these teachings from the Buddha and seen, received the beautiful example of our teachers and the faith that that quickens has the potential to inspire us to do what we need to be doing. Not assuming that just because it feels intolerable that it actually is intolerable. It's the same with, you know, sitting meditation and, oh, this meditation is so boring. Really what I want to do is look at my phone and see if anybody sent me a message. It's nice to get nice messages from people who say nice things. Maybe somebody sent me a nice message. I really want to look at it. What do we do in that situation? What do we do? Well, we could get judgmental and say, oh, I shouldn't be wanting to look at my phone. I should be meditating. Compulsory judging ourselves, up in our heads, having an opinion about how we should or shouldn't be, imagining the together, integrated, competent me who doesn't want to look at their smartphone and wants to just meditate and commit their lives to developing selfless wisdom and compassion. We can do that and spend hours thinking about how we should be. Or we could also come down into our bodies, into our hearts, and if you can access open-hearted awareness, feel wanting to look at your phone. Really, fully want. I want to look at my phone. Seriously want. Not get lost in wanting, of course. If we are new at this, at the time it can look like it's too much. I can't handle this. I'm going to be overwhelmed by wanting. That's the way it appears. That's again why faith and true principle, why patient endurance, why these particular competences are so important that we develop them. Well, that's the investigation. No promises. So, although the journey does present all of us with obstructions, the assumption that the obstructions that we encounter are insurmountable, that's an assumption. Let's not believe that. Let's turn to faith. Let's turn to trust. Let's turn to the example of our spiritual teachers. Let's turn to patience. Let's turn to inquiry and see if we can see beyond the way things appear to be. And certainly I can share my enormous gratitude that it's true that, yeah, many years of my practice have been intensely difficult. In fact, I would say the first 45 years of my life as a monk were the most difficult. However, these days, although I still consider myself a beginner, I'm a somewhat more contented beginner. Thank you very much for your attention.